We're going to take a look, too, after reviewing the Christian-West negotiation, we're going to take a look as well at the negotiations that Alan Dulles was conducting with SS General Karl Wolff to effect a surrender of acts of the SS forces in Italy. And this was being seen by Alan Dulles as a means of stemming the second communist front. There was a huge partisan war going on in Italy after the formal collapse of Mussolini's government, and this was not pleasing to the Western allies. In addition to Alan Dulles and his negotiations with Karl Wolff, we're going to take a look at the role, the very sympathetic pro-Axis role played in these negotiations by Pope Pius XII, formerly Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, whose pro-Axis activities we talked about in RFA 17. And we're going to take a look at the person who functioned as the liaison officer between Karl Wolff and Alan Dulles. This was former SS man Eugen Dohlmann. He was the individual we looked at in a past broadcast who was arrested, functioning on behalf of the Nazi Party in exile. He was given a wrist slap, basically, and was able to resume his activities. The Naumann coup plotters, also representing the Nazi Party in exile, got off scot-free. Eugen Dohlmann got a tiny wrist slap, and we're going to take a look at Dolman's role as a liaison between Karl Wolff and Alan Dulles. After that, we're going to take a look again at a section of the book called... we're going to take a look at the Free Congress Foundation, again, a very significant element not only in American society, but also now in Eastern Europe. And we're going to take a look at how the Free Congress Foundation basically adopted the views and even co-opted much of the political organization of explicitly fascist political parties in the United States. And we're going to take a look at its organizational structure, reminiscent in certain respects, at least, not necessarily corresponding to, but reminiscent of some of the structures of the Nazi Party in exile as projected, the Nazi Party underground as projected by Kurt Rees in the book The Nazis Go Underground. Following that, we're going to take a look at we're going to return again to the book The Nazis Go Underground, and we're going to take a look at a very interesting projection by Kurt Rees in 1944 of one of the ways in which the Third Reich would seek to survive its military defeat. Namely, in one of his chapters, Kurt Rees discusses at some length the projected plans on behalf of the coming Third Reich Underground to hook up with fundamentalists in the United States, religious fundamentalists and certain Protestant sects of explicitly fascist sympathies and activities, or merely some that were opposed to anti-Semitic or opposed to modernism. Again, by way of foreshadowing our return to the present next week. By the way, for those who eventually hear this on tape, today is October 4th of 1992, and in the recent, or not recent, but a couple of months ago in the Republican convention in Houston, the religious far right was seen to be very much in command of the Republican Party, and as we shall see, these elements were actually targeted by the Third Reich as it planned to go underground. They were viewed as a very fertile field in which the Third Reich could plow, and we're going to take a look at the projected role of religious fundamentalists for a Third Reich survival back in 1944. In particular, we're going to take a look at people like Gerald L. K. Smith and Cross and the Flag and his Christian Mobilizers organization. Gerald L. K. Smith was an ardent fascist who ultimately, his organization spawned the Aryan Nations group, which evolved into the Idaho compound of Richard Butler. We're going to take a look at the post-war activities of Gerald L. K. Smith and company, and we're going to take a look at how the H.L. Hunt family, the Hunt family and the Hunt organization, became a post-World War II vehicle for propaganda generated by people like Gerald L. K. Smith. Recall that the Hunt interests and some of the Third Reich alumni functioning on behalf of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, people like Theodor Oberlander, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, they had indeed hooked up with the Hunts, and the Hunts were acting as a vehicle for the propaganda of Gerald L. K. Smith in the post-World War II period, indicating that at least to a certain extent, to what extent we can't say, but at least to a certain extent, the projections by Kurt Rees in 1944 that religious fundamentalists of fascist sympathies or anti-Semitic sympathies would be ultimately utilized as allies in the United States by the Third Reich, going underground. To a certain extent, at least, that has happened. And the last thing that we'll be looking at this evening, hopefully we will have time to get to it. If not, we'll get to it next week. We're going to touch on an item that we used in Radio Free America number 3, namely that after his formal retirement from the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, Reinhard Gehlen, the lifelong German general staff officer, the lifelong anti-Soviet spy and anti-communist crusader, the individual so close to the SS during World War II, well, what did Reinhard Gehlen do after his formal retirement from the BND? He became an evangelist, and we're going to take a look at Reinhard Gehlen getting religion as the last item in the broadcast this evening. Again, if I don't have time to get to all of this evening, the rest will be included next week. So we're going to take a look at the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, its national security establishment, how that national security establishment functioned inside of the United States, how the forces that we've looked at in other installments of this Radio Free America 37 broadcast, how they were functioning in conjunction with what was basically an unreconstructed Reich. Denazification of Germany, unfortunately, as we have seen, was a myth. And we're going to take a look at the elements and the people that we've looked at in past broadcasts and how they functioned as surrogates of and as witting or unwitting agents of an unreconstructed Third Reich. And we're going to begin swinging back over to this side of the Atlantic tonight, hopefully, if not next week. We're going to take a look at the implications of what I've been going over in this massive archive show for the United States, and next week we will swing right back up, as I said, to the unpleasant present. Okay, so that's what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back to the main body of tonight's program, Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. We're going to proceed with the main body of tonight's installment of Radio Free America number 37. In the past couple of weeks, we have been taking a look at the reinstitution of Third Reich elements, of Nazis, at all levels of the West German government. Now, of course, the German government. We took a look at the reinstitution of the Nazi court system, the reinstitution of the industrialists and financiers who had supported Hitler, the reinstitution of political forces sympathetic to Adolf Hitler, and we also took a look at the reinstitution of the civil service of the Third Reich. All of that in the past several weeks. What we're going to look at this evening is the reconstitution of the national security establishment, or the building and the makeup of the national security establishment of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. And specifically, we're going to see the reconstitution of that national security establishment from the national security establishment of the Third Reich. This by way of understanding the state on whose behalf the Gehlen organization was operating, both when it was the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, as well as the NATO intelligence organization, and when it finally became the BND, although it continued to wield profound influence on the United States. And bear in mind two of the central concepts to my working hypothesis here in Radio Free America 37, the Third Reich's tactic of using anti-communism, fear of communism, as a vehicle for conquest, and also the Gehlen organization as a Trojan horse inside the United States. We're going to begin by taking a look at a book called Heusinger of the Fourth Reich that was authored by Charles R. Allen Jr., A-L-L-E-N. Heusinger's Heusinger. This book was published in softcover by Marzani and Munzel, Marzani and Munsell. Copyrighted 1963, in fact, ironically enough, authored in September. It was published in September of 1963, just a couple of months before President Kennedy was assassinated. What we're going to look at now is the farewell address given by Admiral von Dönitz to the German General Staff. This was delivered at Flemsburg, and this was the farewell address of von Dönitz, who had succeeded Adolf Hitler as the Führer of the Third Reich, only for a period of a few days. And in the farewell address by von Dönitz to the German General Staff, we will see the plans of the Third Reich and its national security establishment in particular to use an alliance with the Western powers to regain Germany's lost territories, as we have seen and will continue to see that plan was fulfilled. Allen writes of von Dönitz's farewell address to the German, to the Nazi officer corps, but from Flemsburg, and again that's F-L-E-M-S-B-E-R-G, but from Flemsburg, the last tenuous capital of what remained of Nazi Germany, Dönitz delivered the farewell address to the Nazi officer corps. Quote, "Comrades, it must be clear to all of us that we are now fully in the enemy's hands. Our fate before us is dark. What they will do with us we do not know, but what we have to do we know very well. We have been set back for 1,000 years in our history. Land that was German for 1,000 years has now fallen into Russian hands. Therefore, the political line we must follow is very plain. It is clear that we have to go along with the Western powers and work with them in the occupied territories in the West, for it is only through working with them that we can have hopes of later retrieving our land from the Russians." Last sentence again. "It is clear that we have to go along with the Western powers and work with them in the occupied territories in the West, for it is only through working with them that we can have hopes of later retrieving our land from the Russians." That again, the farewell address to the Nazi officer corps by Admiral von Dönitz, who had succeeded Adolf Hitler as Führer of the Third Reich. Bear in mind, again, this is actually before the formal end of World War II, and already we can see in the plans as laid out by von Dönitz the pattern for the prosecution of the Cold War by NATO. Recall that NATO basically was an outgrowth of the Christian West concept, another central theme of Radio Free America 37, the Christian West concept, a Third Reich plan to survive military defeat by having a Hitlerless Reich hook up with the United States, Germany, and the United States, Britain, and France in an anti-Soviet alliance with Germany as the keystone of that alliance. Now take note of something else that we have looked at before, and now that was Admiral von Dönitz in his farewell address to the Nazi officer corps, foreshadowing in a chilling way what was to come later. We're going to take a look at what Reinhard Gehlen, again, was intending also before the end of World War II. This comes from an article we've used before entitled Reinhard Gehlen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby. This is from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35 from the fall of 1990. By the way, Covert Action Information Bulletin is the best publication about the U.S. intelligence community. It is a quarterly. For those of you who would like to obtain back issues and or subscribe, the address is Covert Action Information Bulletin, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. Again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. Now let's take a look at the extent to which Reinhard Gehlen's plans for the post-war period correspond precisely to what Admiral von Dönitz foreshadowed in his farewell address to the Nazi officer corps. Carl Oglesby writes as follows in Reinhard Gehlen, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. "In December of 1943, at the latest, Gehlen reached the same conclusion about the war that had come upon Bormann, Schacht, Skorzeny, and Himmler. Germany was losing and could do nothing about it. Several months later, Gehlen says, he began quietly discussing the impending defeat with a few close associates. As he writes in his memoir, quote, "Early in October of 1944, I told my more intimate colleagues that I considered the war was lost and we must begin thinking of the future. We had to think ahead and plan for the approaching catastrophe," unquote. Gehlen's strategic response to Götterdämmerung was a kind of fusion of Himmler's philosophy with Bormann's more pessimistic Odessa line. Quote, "My view," he writes, again quoting, "was that there would be a place even for Germany in a Europe rearmed for defense against communism. Therefore, we must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives, to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories." Last sentence again. "Therefore, We must set our sights on the Western powers and give ourselves two objectives: to help defend against communist expansion and to recover and reunify Germany's lost territories. Again, with both von Dönitz and Galen, before the end of the war, we see foreshadowed the future, basically what was to become the history of the Cold War. As a result of the Cold War, Germany did indeed regain its lost territories, or at least East Germany, and figures to become the dominant power not only in Western Europe, but Eastern Europe as well over a period of time. Their present significant difficulties vis-a-vis reunification notwithstanding. And by the way, for those of who eventually hear this program on tape, this is October 4th of 1992, 10-4, and 10-4 is basically how I feel as examining this particular information. Skipping ahead in the Oglesby article, we're going to take a look now at firm indications that the German chain of command, supposedly dissolved with the end of World War II, was in fact functioning. We've covered this before. Oglesby writes, "Indeed, a partly declassified CIA document recapitulated this story in the early 1970s, noting that at this time, quote, Galen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too," unquote. In other words, Oglesby goes on to add, "In other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans." And in a footnote, Oglesby develops further, "As Galen was about to leave for the United States, he left a message for Baun," that's Hermann Baun, B-A-U-N, one of his top aides, beginning again, "As Galen was about to leave for the United States, he left a message for Baun with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel, W-E-S-S-E-L, quote, I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Dönitz and Chief of Staff General Franz Halder the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement," unquote. So, again, note the similarities in the plans of both Galen and von Dönitz for the post-World War II period to use an alliance with the Western powers, basically the Christian West concept, to regain Germany's territories, and note that the German chain of command, supposedly dissolved, was in fact still operating at this time. By way of review also, let's skip ahead in this same Oglesby article and take a look at a key provision of Galen's agreement with the Americans. Quote, should the organization at any time, this is the Galen organization, beginning again, should the organization at any time find itself in a position where the American and German interests diverged, it was accepted that the organization would consider the interests of Germany first, unquote. Galen acknowledges that the last point especially might, quote, raise some eyebrows, unquote, and make some think that the U.S. side, quote, had gone overboard in making concessions to us, unquote. He assures his readers that actually, again quoting, this point demonstrates better than any other Siebert's great vision. He recognized that for many years to come, the interests of the United States and West Germany must run parallel. Well, of course, General Edwin Siebert was the fellow who first established contact with Galen, and as we've seen, he was put in contact with Galen as a result of the suggestions of Alan Dulles' aide and Third Reich spy Giro von Gebernitz, who was centrally involved in the Christian-West negotiations. And again, bear in mind that from the standpoint of the Third Reich, even though the United States might be used to further Germany's interests, but from the standpoint of the Third Reich, American and German interests would always diverge. Okay, so again, take a look at what von Dönitz was projecting in his farewell address to the Nazi officer corps, using the West to regain Germany's lost territories. Galen had the same thing in mind before the end of the war. We've seen Galen submitting his approval to von Dönitz, again, indicating that the German chain of command was still, for all practical purposes, in effect, and that Galen basically would favor German interests where American and German interests diverged. We're going to return to a book that we've used a considerable amount in the past several weeks. What we're going to look at now is the reconstitution of the German General Staff and the pivotal role played by the Galen Organization in that, this by way of coming to understand the nature of the national security establishment of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. That national security establishment obviously functioning in very intimate, in a very intimate way with our own. And again, the Christian West concept, a Third Reich survival concept, was the seed for NATO. Obviously, the two most powerful nations in NATO were the U.S. and Germany. We're going to turn now, as we examine the rebirth of the German General Staff, we're going to return to the book The New Germany and the Old Nazis. This book was published by Random House. It's authored by T.H. Tettens, T-E-T-E-N-S, published in hardcover by Random House and copyrighted 1961. Now, what we're going to take a look at here is the role of the Naumann Group. Again, Dr. Werner Naumann, a key aide to Joseph Goebbels during the Third Reich and designated in Hitler's will to become Goebbels' successor, Werner Naumann and his fellow plotters in the 1953 coup attempt were functioning on behalf of a Nazi party in exile, just as Kurt Ries had projected in 1943. The Third Reich was indeed able to go underground and functioning in the friendly climes of Franco's fascist Spain. They were able to set up an effective Nazi party in exile, and as we've seen, the Naumann Group and the Nazi party in exile wielded a profound influence over the Adenauer government. Again, for people that are hearing these broadcasts for the first time, this might seem really off the wall, but I submit the documentation presented in the last several episodes of RFA 37 by way of shoring up that particular assertion. Returning now, oh, by the way, T.H. Tettens was a prominent German anti-fascist and a writer on the subject. His background is detailed at some length in previous broadcasts. Reading now from The New Germany and the Old Nazis, take a look at the role for, well, the first thing we're going to look at here is something called the Bruderschaft. This was basically a brotherhood organization among former German officers and SS functionaries that began functioning as an underground institution of the Third Reich's General Staff and its National Security Establishment. Recall that in an earlier broadcast, we saw that how the German army itself, the German General Staff, had begun planning for defeat as early as October of 1941. They realized they could not knock the Soviet Union out of the war before the bitter Russian winter set in. Beyond that, with the United States about to enter the war, because they knew that Japan would attack the United States, they realized they were going to lose. Of the Bruderschaft and its birth, or its functioning, in the immediate post-World War II period, T.H. Tettens writes as follows. During the war, the Allies had solemnly stipulated that it was their, quote, inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism and to ensure that Germany will never again be able to disturb the peace of the world, unquote. At Potsdam in August 1945, they decided that, quote, all war veterans organizations and all other military and quasi-military organizations, together with all clubs and associations which serve to keep alive the military tradition in Germany, shall be completely and finally abolished in such a manner as permanently to prevent the revival of reorganization of German militarism and Nazism, unquote. In spite of this Allied resolution, some high SS and Wehrmacht officers in the POW camp soon began to form a closely knit secret organization, the so-called Bruderschaft, or Brotherhood. By the way, it's B-R-U-D-E-R-S-C-H-A-F-T. This organization flourished even during the American occupation, laying the plans for a German comeback. The Bruderschaft became the focal point for a vast network of pro-Nazi activities in and outside of the POW camps. Behind it was a well-financed underground stretching all over Germany with contacts in Italy, Spain, and Argentina. The Bruderschaft worked closely with another organization, the Kameradenhilfswerk, especially designed for the legal defense and care of the war criminals. By the way, it's spelled K-A-M-E-R-A-D-E-N-H-I-L-F-S-W-E-R-K. During the first 2 years of the occupation, the Bruderschaft had to operate secretly. The inner circle, the Bruderschaft, was made up of some top SS functionaries and important officers from the general staff. Among the leaders were the former commander of the Panzergross Deutschland division, Lieutenant General Kurt von Manteuffel, a high SS officer, Alfred Frank Griech, who had once served in Himmler's Reich Security Office, the former leader of the Hitler Youth, Gottfried Griesmeier, the ex-Gauleiter Lauterbach, stationed in Italy and directing the external affairs of the Bruderschaft, and finally, the former Gauleiter Karl Kaufmann, a close link to Dr. Naumann and Dr. Achenbach. Spellings on those names, by the way. Kurt von Manteuffel, M-A-N-T-E-U-F-F-E-L-L. Alfred Frank Griech, F-R-A-N-K-E hyphen G-R-I-E-K-S-C-H. Griesmeyer, G-R-I-E-S-S-M-A-Y-E-R. Lauterbach, L-A-U-T-E-R-B-A-C-H. Kaufmann, K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N. Naumann and Achenbach we've spelled before. Now note, here is an underground organization of Wehrmacht and SS officers functioning in conjunction with the worldwide Nazi underground, and in particular with very close links to Dr. Naumann and Dr. Achenbach, representing the Nazi Party in Exile in Madrid, Spain. That organization, the Nazi Party in Exile, as we have seen, although this will seem like, quote, Buck Rogers stuff, unquote, to the uninitiated, wielded a profound influence on the Adenauer government. Of the early consideration of the remilitarization of Germany, T.H. Tettens writes as follows. The question of German remilitarization came up as early as 1946, when Dr. Adenauer and the CDU politician Dr. Karl Spieker first made their suggestion for a European Union based on an integrated European army. In the summer of 1948, Dr. Adenauer submitted to U.S. authorities a secret memorandum proposing the implementation for rearming 25 divisions. By the way, Spieker is S-P-I-E-K-E-R. On July 30th, 1948, the U.S. News and World Report carried the item, quote, U.S. military officials in Germany are talking in terms of a rebuilding of the German army as an offset to Russian strength in Europe. Yet there were great difficulties in the way of German rearmament. Oh, by the way, end quote after Europe. Tettens goes on to write, Yet there were great difficulties in the way of German rearmament. The French, the British, and the smaller European countries were in deadly fear of a revived militaristic Germany. The outbreak of the Korean War, June of 1950, brought a total change. The provisions which banned all military and veterans organizations lost all their meaning and were no longer enforced. Western Germany was allowed by the Allies to set up its own general staff, camouflaged under the name Blank Office. Supported by Bonn and tolerated by the United States, a nationwide network was created to reactivate the experienced officers and the manpower of the old Wehrmacht. The short period of 1950 and 51 must be marked as the time when Hitler's old officers, SS leaders, and party functionaries returned to positions of power and influence. With the eyes of the world directed toward the hectic events of the Korean conflict, and with Cold War tensions mounting, the SS and Wehrmacht officers had an ideal smokescreen behind which to mobilize their forces. The political objective was a repeat performance of the alliance formed in 1930 between the Nazi Party, the Ultranationalists, and the Stahlhelm veterans, which 2 years later brought the downfall of the Weimar Republic. Stahlhelm, S-T-A-H-L-H-E-L-M, that was a militaristic, ultranationalistic organization of World War I veterans that allied with the Nazi Party, as indicated here. So far, what we've seen is the growth, the functioning of a Bruderschaft, basically an underground organization of Third Reich military and Wehrmacht and SS officers working with the representatives of the Nazi Party in exile. We have seen the suggestion as early as 1946 by the Germans for the remilitarization of Germany as part of a unified European army. On July 30th, 1948, the U.S. News and World Report is discussing the possibility of the U.S. rearming Germany to offset Soviet strength in Europe. Now, bear in mind that in an earlier installment, we saw how the Galen Organization fed the United States gross disinformation about the nature of Soviet forces in Eastern Europe and Eastern Germany and the intentions and capabilities of the Soviet Union in the Cold War period. These exaggerated reports of the Soviet Union contributed undoubtedly to the sentiment in the United States to rearm Germany. Note also the profound effect here that the outbreak of the Korean War had. It permitted the rejuvenation of the German General Staff, and that under the camouflage name of Blank Office. And as we're going to see, anti-communism, again, the fear of communism, was utilized very effectively by the, quote, new, unquote, Germany to reconstitute a national security establishment from the residua of the Third Reich's national security establishment. What we're going to look at next is the significant role played by Dr. Werner Naumann, again functioning as a representative of the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, for setting up veterans organizations, which in turn paved the way for a remilitarization of Germany and ultimately a reconstitution of the German General Staff. Continuing, resuming with the last sentence, last couple of sentences of the previous paragraph by T.H. Tettens. With the eyes of the world directed toward the hectic events of the Korean conflict, and with Cold War tensions mounting, the SS and Wehrmacht officers had an ideal smokescreen behind which to mobilize their forces. The political objective was a repeat performance of the alliance formed in 1930 between the Nazi Party, the Ultranationalists, and the Stahlhelm veterans, which 2 years later brought the downfall of the Weimar Republic. The figure behind this plan was Dr. Werner Naumann, who in 1950 found the situation sufficiently safe to allow him to emerge from his hiding place. Commanding a vast pool of old party connections from the propaganda ministry, the SS, the bureaucracy, and the Wehrmacht, Naumann was in an excellent position to make things move and to give advice on strategy and tactics. Through his close association with the corporation lawyer Dr. Achenbach, he was able to mobilize the financial resources of the industrial royalists on Rhine and Ruhr. Naumann was the directing spirit behind almost every organization and neo-Nazi publication that sprang up between 1950 and 1951. Beginning again, Naumann was the directing spirit behind almost every organization and neo-Nazi publication that sprang up between 1950 and 1951. And again, bear in mind that through Dr. Achenbach, another Third Reich alumni, a Third Reich alumnus, he was able to mobilize the resources of the German industrialists. And again, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 2 and in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Radio Free America 2 from May of 84, Uncle Sam and the Swastika from May of 80, that those industrialists and financiers were put right back into power by the American industrialists and financiers with whom they had worked for a long time. Continuing now with T.H. Tettens' account of the remilitarization of Germany, when the British handed over the evidence on the Naumann plot to the Bonn authorities in 1953, the Minister of Justice, Dr. Lehr, L-E-H-R, declared that, quote, Dr. Naumann had pulled the strings from behind and used every opportunity to exert his political influence over all veterans organizations. Again, quoting, Dr. Naumann had pulled the strings from behind and used every opportunity to exert his political influence over all veterans organizations, unquote. In July of 1951, 30 former generals and admirals gathered in Bonn for a two-day conference at which the, quote, question of German rearmament was discussed, unquote. At that time, in addition to the SS-HIAG, two other veterans organizations had been founded. One was the Stahlhelm, an extreme nationalistic group. The other called itself the Deutscher Soldatenbund, the Federation of German Soldiers. By the way, Soldatenbund, S-O-L-D-A-T-E-N-B-U-N-D. Beginning again, one was the Stahlhelm, an extreme nationalistic group. The other called itself the Deutscher Soldatenbund, Federation of German Soldiers, and immediately after its inception claimed a membership of 85,000. The spirit of both organizations was expressed in their selection of two convicted war criminals as honorary presidents. The Stahlhelm's choice was Field Marshal Kesselring, and the Soldiers Federation selected former Admiral Erich Raeder, who at that time was serving his sentence in the Spandau prison. Kesselring, of course, K-E-S-S-E-L-R-I-N-G, Raeder, R-A-E-D-E-R. Continuing. More significant was the founding of numerous Traditionsverbände, representing former Wehrmacht divisions and special army groups such as the Afrika Korps, the Navy League, and the paratroopers known as the Green Devils. By the way, that Traditionsverbände, T-R-A-D-I-T-I-O-N-S-V-E-R-B-A-E-N-D-E. The ex-soldier organization started off with noisy nationalistic rallies. A few months later, the U.S. High Commissioner noted the emergence of an, quote, increased number of extreme rightist and ultranationalist organizations, unquote. He admitted that the highest-ranking officers of the Wehrmacht were back in politics, organizing the veterans and, quote, stocking the merchandise of nationalism, unquote. The High Commissioner noted with deep concern that, quote, even some federal ministers appear as nationalistic as the extremists. So again, in this passage, we began by taking a look at the Bruderschaft, basically an underground organization of Wehrmacht and regular German SS and regular German military officers, how it functioned underground in conjunction with the worldwide Nazi underground, and in particular with the Nazi Party in exile, how it had connections with Dr. Naumann and Dr. Achenbach representing that Nazi Party in exile and having profound influence on the Adenauer government. We then took a look at the plan coordinated by Dr. Naumann to help to revive German militarism by founding veterans organizations, ultra-militaristic and nationalistic organizations. These organizations grew directly out of the Third Reich, and the Traditionsverbände basically served as vehicles for following the Naumann plan. Recall that the U.S., as early as 48, was talking about rearming Germany to help offset Soviet strength in Europe, that strength having been greatly exaggerated in U.S. eyes by the Galen Organization, and recall how the Korean War basically paved the way for the revival of the German General Staff, as we have seen. And again, bear in mind, one of the central principles of RFA 37, the use of the strategic use of anti-communism by the Third Reich as a vehicle for conquest. And don't forget what Galen and von Dönitz were projecting before the German defeat. What we're going to look at now is how the German General Staff survived after World War I, and how the miniaturization program put together by German General Hans von Seeckt, again spelled S-E-E-C-K-T, was used to lay the foundation for the rapid expansion of the German army. Although limited to a very small army by the Treaty of Versailles, von Seeckt put into effect a program in which all members of this small German army were trained to assume a rank high above them, basically even relative people in the lower ranks of the German army were trained to assume leadership roles, so that when it came time for Adolf Hitler to expand the German armed forces, that could be accomplished very readily because people were able to move up several ranks and assume officer positions even though they had been relatively far down in the German army, because under von Seeckt they had received officer training as a result of his miniaturization program. What we're going to take a look at later, after examining von Seeckt's program, is how the Galen organization in some ways could be seen as analogous to, or functioning in a manner analogous to, the way the von Seeckt miniaturization program worked, just as von Seeckt basically had an expanded German army in microcosm set up within the small army allowed it by the Treaty of Versailles. The Galen organization itself, as we shall see, served as the vehicle not only for the perpetuation of the German General Staff, but for the reconstitution of the German General Staff, that having been arranged by Adolf Heusinger, about whom we shall have more to say later. About Hans von Seeckt and his miniaturization program, his setting up of a military microcosm, we're going to return again to the book Heusinger of the Fourth Reich by Charles Allen. Of von Seeckt and his military microcosm, Allen writes as follows. Seeckt's special genius, quote, lay not in the formation of large armies, unquote, wrote the Oxford Don Wheeler Bennett in his definitive study of the German General Staff, again quoting, but in the creation of a military microcosm, complete within itself in every detail, yet capable at the given moment of limitless expansion. Wheeler Bennett, by the way, capital W-H-W-E-L-E-R hyphen B-E-N-N-E-T-T. Continuing. The scheme was literally nuclear in concept. It was von Seeckt's army, quote, in little, unquote, where each senior officer was so trained, in secret, of course, that he could command a division, each junior officer a battalion, each non-commissioned officer was a potential officer, and each private could quickly step up as a non-com, so that each separate unit could, on the day needed, immediately expand into the full regimental structure of the Third Reich. Sir Winston Churchill, in his mammoth study of the Second World War, wrote in The Gathering Storm that as a result of Sake's assiduously meticulous plans, an actuary could have well estimated the terrible odds which the Allies finally faced in 1940 when the massed Nazi armies outnumbered them by nearly 3-1. Continuing, the Secret Army needed above all clever, sophisticated minds to direct its burgeoning manpower, to provide what Wheeler Bennett called its, quote, brain and genius, unquote. This, of course, was the German General Staff, which, after World War I, as after the Second World War, had ostensibly been outlawed for the safety and sanity of the world. Quote, of primary concern, unquote, to von Seeckt, wrote Wheeler Bennett, again quoting, was the conservation of the spirit and essence of the German General Staff, specifically and explicitly dissolved and prohibited by the Versailles Treaty. For without the survival of this palladium, the brain and genius of the army would wither and atrophy, unquote. But how could Sake accomplish this, quote, primary concern, unquote, in the face of Versailles? As the contemporary German historian Walter Görlitz, himself an apologist for Heusinger, by the way, as the contemporary German historian, Walter Görlitz, G-O-E-R-L-I-T-Z, himself an apologist for Heusinger, by the way, remarked while Versailles prohibited the general staff, quote, it did not, however, forbid the Truppengeneralstab, the operational general staff, unquote, which was the very, quote, colonel, unquote, that von Seeckt deliberately, again quoting, transplanted into the new German army, unquote, in order to accomplish his ends. The retention of the essence of German militarism, the brain and genius of the General Staff. By the way, Truppengeneralstab, Truppengeneralstab. Resuming with Allen's text, it was to this, quote, colonel, unquote, that von Seeckt summoned the up-and-coming junior officer Adolf Ernst Heusinger of the Bavarian Army. In 1923, Heusinger was chosen for the elite General Staff Officer Corps to be trained specifically in the Truppengeneralstab. Heusinger was already at 26 younger by 7 years than von Seeckt had been in 1899 when the monocled Junker had been transferred to the General Staff. So again, the military microcosm set up by von Seeckt permitted the rapid expansion of the German army under Hitler, and permitted the survival of the German General Staff. And again, in some ways, I'm not suggesting this is a perfect analogy, but in some ways the Galen Organization can be thought of as having functioned in an analogous fashion. What we're going to take a look at next is the career of the rise of Adolf Heusinger. And again, Adolf Heusinger held the title of Chief of Operations and Planning of the Oberkommando der Heere, all of the land forces of Hitler's armies, and was one of the principal figures in the Third Reich's military structure, was deeply involved with setting up every Nazi military campaign from 1940 on, including and especially the invasion of the Soviet Union.